Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Last Battleship 3, Gates to Hell, by Joshua T. Calvert. Narrated by Eric Altheide. Prologue. Jump successful, Chief Petty Officer Feng reported from power control. The young NCO was surrounded by several displays at the center of the semicircle formed by the bridge crew arrayed in front of Captain Anchala Krusnik. Power matrices at 20%. Pattern cells depleted, recharging. Containment chamber integrity at 100%.
Very good. So, can we make it back with our antimatter supply?
Anchala asked. I think so, sir. But as expected, this system will be the last, I'm afraid. Anchala leaned back in his command chair and looked at the system through the large panoramic window, after the massive beam shields had slid open like a mighty portal. To the right loomed a partial silhouette of the local gas giant. Nearby was the gravitational conjunction zone that had functioned as their exit from hyperspace. Ahead lay only the twinkle of stars in infinite space. One shone a little brighter, and a few colorful specks were just visible. He gave the order for a complete system scan and acceleration away from the jump point. The TFS Vasco da Gama was one of the oldest research vessels in the Terran fleet, a 100-meter-long cylinder with water tanks attached to it like cartridges in a six-shooter cylinder. Only a negligible fraction of the stored water was used for the ship's life support, including drinking water. Instead, it primarily served as propellant for the ship's extended prospecting voyages. Inside the thicker rear third of the ship was the retrofitted Valkyrie II antimatter reactor, with its impressive array of magnetic coils, and behind it, the propulsion nacelle. Around the long hull, surmounted by the bridge, which resembled a cyclops' eye, was a mighty 80-meter radius ring that contained the quarters and laboratories of the 31 science officers and the 44 crew members, who ensure the researchers could get from system to system to do their work. As with most prospector ships, their families traveled with the crew. Some voyages lasted several years, which was highly unusual for fleet ships. The Vasco da Gama, therefore, contained several unique features. Childcare facilities, noisy mess halls, sports programs, and frequent movie nights. Anchala had had to listen to a lot of jokes from his comrades on Eden before starting the trip. Bus driver, nanny, and field trip teacher were just some of the monikers they had jokingly hung around his neck. He didn't mind. The fleet was a rather tedious place for a commanding officer. Duties typically consisted of endless underpaid patrols along the trade routes to hunt down pirates or maintain order at the jump points. The Federation forces were plagued by what had always plagued the military in peacetime. Inactivity, lack of recognition among the civilian population, constantly shrinking budgets, and aging hardware. The second expansion phase was over. The first fringe worlds were now core worlds, and everything was subordinated to hypercapitalism. All this made the Federation rich. 2 centuries of peace were enough to drive the transformation of the defense fleet into a research fleet. Anchala knew this, which was why he was here. He was a man who preferred to be the first to show up at the party so he could choose the dance music. Expeditionary ventures were the future for skippers like him, not endless maneuvers and patrols. If heading for the stars and exploring the Federation's frontiers meant flying families through space instead of soldiers, then he was happy to hear his comrades deride his voyage as a field trip, knowing they were probably jealous that he had an exciting job. Well, at least in theory. The last 30 systems they had approached in the past 41 months had all been disappointing, populated only by gas giants and either frozen or ultra-hot planets that could not even serve as industrial outposts because their jump points were so small that the big freighters could not rip open a sufficiently large terminus. Anchala had long since said goodbye to his actual dream of finally discovering intelligent life. Simple microbes and sometimes more complex fungal structures had been collected and analyzed in endless series, but this was not something new. The universe seemed to be not actually dead, but rather stupid. Initial scans show the jump point is stable. The Sal Vicente is just coming out of the event horizon, Lieutenant Carras reported from the sensor station. She is undamaged.
Very good.
The Sal Vicente and her sister ship Garibaldi were the 2 corvettes that served as escorts for the Vasco da Gama since they had joined the voyage as replacements a year ago. They were slender arrows 40 meters in length with no habitat ring, and thus no gravity. That made daily life on board much more unpleasant than on Anchala's ship. He had very quickly become accustomed to sports in normal gravity, as well as sleeping, playing cards, and showering in it. Being a teacher on a field trip had its advantages. He called to his first officer.
Peter, go check on our civilian crew. I want to know if everyone's come through hyper in good shape.
Already on the way.
and prepare them for the fact that we'll have to sterilize the habitat. It may take up to 12 hours before we can fire it up again.
Sure.
His XO floated out of the bridge. They had already waited 2 days longer than planned to perform the habitat's monthly basic cleaning, so as not to delay the schedule any further after the unforeseen repairs they had to make in the last system. With over 100 breathing people on board, the ever-present humidity made mold and microbial infestations a serious problem. Life support fought it, but the microscopic beasts always found a home somewhere. So once every 4 weeks, every square nanometer was disinfected. In a few generations, this could cost them dearly. Longer non-exposure to germs could cause passenger immune systems to degenerate. He was counting on the geneticists to get a handle on it. After all, they were able to grow people red hair, new kidneys, and six-fingered hands.
Very well. Kara, what do you have for us?
He asked his sensor specialist after half an hour, more bored than interested.
2 gas giants, hydrogen, helium, the outermost planets in the system. The last one could be an ice giant, 5 times Earth's mass. The penultimate one, the one we dropped out of the jump point next to, has 2 Jupiter masses and a fair percentage of methane in its outer atmosphere. There's a sterile rocky planet this side of the asteroid belt, and beyond it, a single ice planet, just outside the habitable zone. The innermost planet is also terrestrial, carbon dioxide atmosphere, half Earth mass.
The ice planet. What else do you have there?
80% Earth mass, large semi-major axis of 1.76 astronomical units, sidereal orbit period of 843 standard days, synodic orbital period of 911 standard days. Its mean orbital velocity is 28.8 kilometers per second, gravitational acceleration of 6.99 meters per second squared. All sounds promising, if it wasn't for the frozen oceans. The ice sheet is probably dozens of kilometers thick, and the atmosphere is very thin and rich in sulfur dioxide.
Volcanic activity? Anchala wondered. Then I'm sure our smock wearers will want to go fishing again.
The bridge crew chuckled.
Quite possibly. And it has 2 very small moons that...
What is it?
I'm picking up electromagnetic radiation from the satellites.
Karas said thoughtfully.
Just now?
No, it was there before, but due to our current position, some of the asteroids in the ring interfered with it. The signals are getting clearer now.
Signals?
The radiation indicates high energy profiles that don't match a rocky body.
Comets, perhaps?
Anchala felt stupid as he asked.
No, they are in a captured orbit around the planet.
Then what? Any evidence of technology on the surface?
No, just ice, except for a large hole near the equator where there are some lights. That could be a subcrustal volcano erupting. The only signals are coming from the satellites.
Don't tell me we've run into aliens. If we allow ourselves another premature victory like we did on Tracetus V, which turned out to be radiation anomalies, we'll have to hide our faces in shame.
Anchala grumbled. A slight flutter stirred in his stomach, but he refused to let it grow to a real itch of curiosity. Yet.
I have to wait for some more scans.
Anchala turned to his navigation officer.
Scott, bring us in closer, full speed. That means 2 G's for several hours,
the junior lieutenant objected.
The civilians will be able to make it, and cleaning the habitable ring can wait until later. Sound the acceleration alert. Have everyone get to their gel beds. This one could be important. Roger that.
Shortly thereafter, an ascending alarm tone resounded through the corridors and quarters. Anything that could possibly come loose during the jump was strapped down or stowed, and children were placed on their acceleration couches in the habitat ring and sedated. Anchala waited impatiently as messages from the individual sections gradually appeared on his command display, confirming they could finally get underway. The Sal Vicente stayed behind at the jump point as instructed, while the Garibaldi took up position at the Vasco da Gama side with weapon systems activated as prescribed by the protocols for a possible first contact. After what felt like an eternity, his ship's propulsion nacelle finally flared up, accelerating her at a gentle 2 G's. It wasn't much, but enough over an extended period to bring her to an appreciable fraction of the speed of light and bring her rapidly to her targets of investigation. Tension reigned on the bridge for the ensuing 12 hours. Anchala did not need to read the minds of his crew to know what was going on inside them. Evidence was mounting that the 2 moons were using technology that tapped artificial energy sources. This could only mean that they were dealing with some form of intelligence. No one wanted to say it, lest others regard them as overzealous or even unprofessional. But they were all thinking it. First contact. When they passed the asteroid belt, they debated whether the power could be the relic of some long-dead alien culture, or a machine intelligence, which frightened them all. The possibility of encountering intelligences that turned out to be non-organic, either as remnants of a vanished organic civilization or as its weapon, was a frequently debated topic in the Federation. The results of these discussions were always that the latter case would represent a disaster, since machine beings would probably evolve much faster and weren't constrained by the same physical and mental limits imposed on human space travel by factors like radiation and acceleration forces. He envied the civilians in the habitat ring, who were strapped on their couches and killing time with VR programs without worrying about any of the things that were bothering the crew. Discussion died as they left the last asteroids behind, and Lieutenant Carraw gave a shrill shout.
Radar contacts!
LIDAR sweep!
Anchala's order was as automatic as it was unnecessary.
Confirmed. 3 bogies approaching from the larger of the satellites.
On screen.
The twinkling stars and the bluish glow of the small blue dot they were heading for were superimposed on a holo display showing 3 exhaust flares. The bow telescope zoomed in several magnification factors and showed 3 chunky drops of dark material approaching them at a rather gentle 2.5 Gs.
They're ships, he noted. No doubt about it. This is first contact, ladies and gentlemen.
Cheers erupted on the bridge, though it resonated with a detectable undertone of fear. They were now flying blind into the unknown, into a situation that the Federation's brightest minds had imagined for centuries without ever reaching any clear conclusions about what to expect from such an event. But the fleet wouldn't be the fleet if it didn't have a protocol for such situations.
All right, open a channel, radio only, no directional beam, he said, breaking through the excited chatter on the bridge.
Channel open,
Carraw replied.
This is Captain Anchala Kruznik of the Terran Federation ship Vasco da Gama. We send peaceful greetings on behalf of the Federation and its worlds as emissaries of all human civilization,
Anchala announced in a clear baritone. He felt like he was in a science fiction VR. The situation was so surreal that he wanted to bite his lip just to make sure he wasn't dreaming. His address was followed by tense silence as the message crossed the 1.5 light minute distance to the alien ships. The regular blip of the radar and the hiss of the LIDAR scan filled the silence. Only the crinkling foil sounds of computers, all too loud and intrusive, disturbed the pregnant anticipation. After 3 minutes, Lieutenant Carraw visibly tensed.
What's going on, Lieutenant?
I'm picking up something from the ships, but it's very strange.
Why?
The frequency band is one I would expect, but the audio equivalent doesn't sound like a response on waves we can hear.
Turn it up.
A moment later, clicking sounds filled the bridge, as if Edward Scissorhands was playing the piano.
Interference? He asked.
Possible. The cosmic background radiation here is higher than expected, but not high enough to interfere with the radio.
Turn the ship around. Initiate braking maneuvers. I don't want our flight path to be interpreted as an attack. But take it easy, please.
Roger that.
The Vasco da Gama rotated along its transverse axis, like a giant cigar in the middle of a ring, until the massive drive nacelle pointed forward and began spewing blue plasma again. Gravity instantly returned to the ship and pressed them into their gimbaled seats.
Bogies are turning and braking as well.
Okay. They use space technology similar to ours, Anchala thought. Acceleration, drift, brake. Their speed shows they're not prone to breakneck maneuvers. Could they be like us?
Images of every alien face he'd ever seen in VRs rattled through his mind until he squeezed his eyes shut and shook his head to dispel them.
I don't think we're getting anywhere with this. Send the first 5 of the prepared mathematical equations, he ordered.
The Fleet Science Corps had prepared some simple mathematical equations for first contact that could be represented pictorially and without numbers, since aliens probably knew nothing about human character sets. But quantities could be easily expressed in general symbols like dashes, and combined with a few arithmetic symbols that could be derived from the quantities when the result was provided. Again, it was a matter of waiting. An answer came after 2 minutes.
They sent back the equations with supplements,
Carraw noted.
What kind of supplements?
That's not easy to say. I'll play it for you.
On the holoscreen, the first equation appeared. 1 + 1 = 2, followed by a short whistle, a bass note, the same short whistle again, then a click and a long-pitched whistle.
Are you streaming this to the labs in the ring yet?
Anchala asked, and gave an impatient wave when Carraw shook his head.
Tell them to get right on it. What could that be? The aural equivalent of our equation? Maybe they don't have a visual typeface, just sound sequences, Scott suggested. But how are we supposed to answer in sound sequences? Let our smock wearers worry about that. Kara, continue transmitting the images. Again, the first five from the first contact file.
The following hours were much more monotonous than expected. They slowed down, just as the alien ships did, until they hovered in the vacuum of space 20 kilometers from each other. Captain Sartosa of the Garibaldi proved to be a rather nervous fellow, remarking several times that he would only deactivate his weapon systems under logged protest, but he dutifully kept his feet still. The scientists in the labs at the back of the ring seemed to spend forever conferring and endlessly analyzing the transmissions sent by the aliens, who were quickly dubbed clicks by the crew because of the strange clicking signals they constantly emitted. Then they suddenly came up with an idea and tried audio-based messages as well. The response was mostly the same, which they interpreted as, "I don't know what this is supposed to be." They sent geometric forms, and the aliens responded with supplemental symbols that the researchers argued over for hours. Some said these were clever additions to the complexity of the shape, others that it only meant they had not understood, while still others proposed the aliens were trying to tell them something completely different and that they were merely trapped in their own human interpretation framework. Anchala was a diplomated social scientist. It had earned him a lot of ridicule in the fleet, but at least he knew what symbolic interactionism was. A symbol could mean Alpha to him and Omega to a civilization with a completely different reference system. Without any common intersection, misunderstandings were bound to occur. The only thing to do was exercise patience and forbearance and continually remind oneself that no interpretation could stand unchallenged. Even the transmission of an image, like that of an axe, could start a war, even among humans. Did the message senders intend the axe as a tool for cutting down trees and fighting fires, or for splitting skulls? Something as simple as a nail could be understood as a symbol for connecting two unrelated things, or as the instrument of chastisement in a crucifixion, or as the point of an arrow. The list was long, and even in earthly civilization, the symbol did not have a clear meaning without context. Therefore, he understood why first contact was turning out to be much more protracted and boring than most of his crew members had probably imagined. It was entirely human for a spectacle to become a part of a ship's daily routine surprisingly fast. All one could do was wait. At 20 hours after the first exchange of messages, the intercom in his cabin rang and jolted him out of a restless half-sleep.
"What?"
he croaked in a thick voice once his finger found the intercom button above his bunk.
"Dr. Octavius and his team have an idea they'd like to discuss with you," he heard Scott say. "I'm on my way."
Anchala withdrew his finger, ran it through his hair with a sigh, and then tidied himself before leaving his cabin and shuffling down the central corridor to the bridge. There, Scott and Kara were already waiting at their seats.
"Anything new?"
"No, Captain. Nothing significant. Doc thinks they're machine creatures."
"I see. Why?"
"Because their answers suggest binary perception, and they haven't responded to the emotion queries, music, abstract and impressionist imagery, and so on. Math, on the other hand, seems to be what they enjoy dealing with."
"Well, if that's not jumping the gun..."
Anchala dropped into a seat and turned on his armrest display. With two quick gestures, he opened a link to the conference room. The habitat ring was still stationary and undergoing disinfection while the scientists worked.
"Ah, Captain."
Dr. Octavius's massive gray hair, correspondingly small face, and bulbous nose appeared on the tiny display in front of his hand.
"We have come up with an idea that could enable direct communication after all."
"I heard. So, what do you have in mind?"
"We'd like to use the habitat ring as a light organ."
Excuse me?
"Astra glossa."
"Again, I beg your pardon?"
"The plan is this,"
the physicist explained with childlike enthusiasm.
"The ring has 60 high-powered spotlights on flexible arms. They are designed to point forward to allow for maintenance work."
Anchala waved impatiently.
"I'm aware of that."
"If we set a reference point, for example, at one of the spotlights, which we mark with a color by blinking a primary sequence of signals, we can then create complex sequences of long and short pulses by rotating the ring. This is the simplest form of mathematical communication. We already know that they know math over there, and they seem to be patient, too. So we'll try it with Astra Glossa. If that works, we can go one level higher to Linkos. That's a mathematical language with more complex logical symbols that we can use to lay a broader foundation for communication. We'll have the solar foil we use for solar observations deployed and spread between the ring to act as a sensitive pickup mirror for the answers."
That could be feasible. What if the clicks don't have any spotlights to respond with?
We'll find out soon enough. But with the help of light signals, we can work up a simple Morse code. At worst, the absence of a light response would confirm what some of us already suspect, that our cosmic friends out here may not be visual beings at all. That is, they have no eyes, and...
I get that, Doc. I'm putting you in charge of rotation control. But don't forget to strap in first. And you'd best get the kids down to the crew mess. All of you might get sick if gravity is constantly changing direction. He warned, and the physicist nodded eagerly.
Thank you, Captain. We'll get right on it.
Anchala disconnected and waited. The aliens' three clunky teardrop ships were still 20 kilometers in front of them in a simple triangular formation, large black shadows not quite as dark as the universe beyond. In the background was the faint blue glow of the ice planet, and he imagined he could see two glittering dots in front of its silhouette, though he knew it was impossible to make out the supposed space stations without zooming in.
I wonder what they're doing there,
Chief Petty Officer Fang said to no one in particular.
On the planet? Scott shrugged. I guess they're research stations.
Then those are research ships?
Maybe. Or the local Navy to protect the scientists on site?
Nah, Fang said, shaking his head. I still think they're robots. If they weren't, they would have agreed to a picture link by now.
This isn't Star Trek, Scott countered. Aliens aren't just people with wrinkled foreheads or big ears.
No? What are they, then?
Fang wanted to know.
We'll figure that out when smarter people than you have thought about it.
Anchal interrupted the discussion by pointing to the power node specialist and asking, How's the energy redistribution?
It's about to peak. The ring will need 60% of the power available for about 40 seconds to deploy the solar foil inward and bring the nano-assemblers up to full power, unless we take more time, which would only require a fraction of that.
No, I want to keep it that way.
2 minutes later, everything was ready. The habitat ring's superconductor systems were filled to bursting with energy and spreading the pitch-black foil that reflected no light whatsoever before reversing polarity. All the lights flickered several times in succession as part of a systems test. Then, the ring began to spin.
Oh, shit.
Lieutenant Kara cursed.
What is it?
Anchala asked, alarmed by his sensor specialist's sudden change in tone.
Significant power surge in the bogies.
Kara almost choked.
They're transmitting on all frequencies,
Scott shouted from his station on the left as he frantically input instructions. A staccato of eerie clicking filled the bridge, and then several objects that resembled fireflies detached themselves from the dark toroidal alien ships. They quickly increased in size and grew into tiny suns before a hailstorm of other smaller dots rained upon them. Two explosions lit the darkness of vacuum, then another, and three more in quick succession. The defensive fire from the Garibaldi's short-range defenses wasn't enough, despite Captain Sartosa's speed. Four torpedoes slammed into the habitat ring, ripping out entire pieces. One spoke was hit and disintegrated in a shower of charged particles and glowing debris. Some of the wreckage hit the water tanks in the Vasco da Gama's hull, sending the content shooting away in fountains of ice crystals. The solar foil dissolved in a tornado of fine shrapnel invisible to the human eye, as if the sinfully expensive material had never existed. Paralyzed, Anchala watched the habitat ring break up, taking the 58 souls inside with it. Their bodies, torn into space, flailed through the void in brief agony. Then their limbs stiffened as they froze. The Garibaldi fired a volley of its own torpedoes, followed by sustained fire from its two Gauss cannons, but it was destroyed shortly thereafter, perishing in a short-lived white flash when one of the antimatter coils was hit and the entire antimatter supply collided with the nearest molecules, obliterating everything around it, including the TFS Vasco da Gama and its crew. Chapter 1 Fidel Suarez let the swaying motion of the donkey cart lull him into a fitful half-sleep that summoned more memories than dreams. The last 3 days had been hectic as fleet headquarters burst with activity. The tens of thousands of employees manning the Federation's most important military facility flowed ceaselessly through the countless corridors and caverns under the peaks of the Himalayas like termites in a broken mound. Reports from all over the globe converged here, and they painted a rather depressing picture. The cliques had swept all orbital resistance aside after the human defenders had exhausted their last reserves battling the sinister aliens that emerged from the hyperspace gate to Sol. The fact that Artemis and Unity halos had survived was probably due to Fleet Admiral von Solheim.
He had ordered defenders to use their last ammunition reserves to obliterate the shattered remnants of the Novigrad Halo that had been descending toward Earth for 36 hours before they could become a serious threat. By the time the Clicks passed Luna, there was little to oppose them, except the 60 shot-up survivors of Strike Group 12 that the Admiral had ordered into the outer system. It had been decided that what could still fly should not be sacrificed in a futile attempt to protect something that could no longer be protected. Terra was lost. Every member of the fleet and every human with access to a news feed were painfully aware of that. The last civilian ships to jump out of the system via S-1 were truly fortunate. When the Clicks had arrived in orbit, every analyst at headquarters and in the media had expected them to bomb the orbital defense platforms next, then the Zero-G industrial facilities, followed by Luna. But they didn't. The final strategy executed by von Solheim had been a highly controversial one. No resistance. Anger over this had burned so brightly in the corridors under the Himalayas that Fidel had imagined dark smoke billowing from the ventilation shafts and the ice above them, giving away their position. But either the fleet admiral knew something they didn't at headquarters, or he could have taken up a career as a professional gambler. That didn't mean that the aliens had been passive. On the contrary. First, they had blasted the 4 equatorial orbital elevators, then destroyed the one that connected the ground-based and orbital sections of the fleet headquarters. This included the communications panels at both bases, making them effectively unable to talk to each other. Since then, Earth had been cut off from orbit because radio or laser signals were completely useless. The Clicks' massive jamming barrage overwhelmed transmissions with white noise. In addition, they had dumped vast amounts of microcellulose into the upper atmosphere, creating a hazy glow. It would take days, if not weeks, for the ultralight particles to settle to the ground. But they didn't have that much time. Earth was dependent on supplies from the hydroponic farms on Ganymede in Europa. Although it produced enough protein mass for the planet's synthesizers, the moons located at the edge of the inner system were a vital source. With their huge orbital mirrors, they could produce the masses of vitamins and minerals pressed from natural sources needed to enrich the food packs on Terra with vital nutrients. Supplies had not reached Earth for days. It was not something that would kill people in the short term, but the population did not have weeks, let alone months, before famine set in. And the dying would begin. But there was a reason why Fidel Suarez, clad in a nanonic spacesuit overlaid with wool rags against the cold, was driving the rumbling donkey cart over the bumpy gravel roads the Sherpas normally used. He knew the reason as he struggled through the heavy snowdrifts as he tried to make out the pale line that distinguished Mount Everest from the night sky, its moon and stars obscured by the microcellulose fog. There was a chance, a slim one, but a chance nonetheless. The fact that it rested entirely on his narrow shoulders did not worry him. He knew why he, a test pilot for atmospheric hunters, had been chosen for this mission. He knew what was coming and what was at stake. But he did not let that plunge him into irrational thought. He knew he could succeed. So he remained calm and focused on the job ahead while blocking out the desperate need that drove him. A day ago, his superiors tried to shoot an improvised sled along one of the main elevator cables to establish contact with the Sky Fortress, and with Solheim. But the Clicks had immediately vaporized the 2-meter-long device with a laser. In the process, they had nearly severed the cable, which would have been an absolute disaster. If that happened, the entire elevator would shoot into space, and no force in the universe would be able to stop it. They were lucky that the aliens had not aimed for maximum destruction, which they could have easily achieved. They merely had to blast the Unity or Artemis apart and watch the debris turn the Earth into a radioactive hell. Those who didn't die from the massive impacts would be driven back into the Stone Age. A very grim and very slow death would then ensue in the weeks and months afterward. But just because the end of the world had been delayed for the moment was no reason to pop champagne corks. In fact, this unexpected development posed another problem. The enemy was not behaving as predicted. And that was bad news. In war, being able to predict the enemy's next moves was worth more than surprise. The Clicks had made it clear that they were not here for fun. Their targeted bombardment of all ground-based communications facilities and the EMP bombs they detonated over planetary defense centers were ample proof of that. They had also blasted any ship that tried to reach orbit. The result was, in effect, a blockade. They remained strangely passive, aside from the shuttles they sent into the Pacific and Antarctic oceans. Reconnaissance data was sketchy at best, without satellite imagery, but analysts were certain that dozens of shuttles had disappeared into the ocean. Some remained submerged for hours at a time. Others never reappeared at all. Fidel had no idea what that could mean, and it wasn't his job to worry about it. but many of his colleagues were only too eager to engage in conjuring fantastic scenarios. The cliques wanted to enslave them and gradually ship them off to their industrial moons where they would be worked to death in some sort of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?